Scientists in laboratories can now take apart the genes of two living things and recombine them into a brand new living thing. But wait, individuals in basements and garages say, we can do that too. They lead us to ask, should life be free for the making?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 633rd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello.
And Parmley Taff as
Hello.
Well. Folks, the engineering of new life forms, which was once the purview of scientists in multimillion dollar laboratories. I don't know if you ever had the opportunity to see the Genentech facility up there north of San Francisco, but it looks like one of those giant factories that always blow up at the end of James Bond movies. That's where genetic engineering used to take place all the time, but now it's becoming the pastime of hobbyists in basements and garages across the land. Their pursuit of new life forms lead us to some very interesting questions, like, what kinds of life may be created by hobbyists in basements and garages? Will someone or something supervise the creation of life? And who should we trust to do that supervising? Will gene hackers run wild and free like their cousins in the computer world, where hackers and spammers drive us all nuts? And finally, should life be free for the making? Today we have some very interesting guests who are going to join us and talk about these issues. We're going to start with Mackenzie Cowell, who is the founder of DIY Bio. Mackenzie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks a lot, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Speaking of here, you're in San Francisco at what kind of convention?
It's called CodeCon, and it's the convention at which BitTorrent was sort of first announced.
And for those of us who don't know what BitTorrent?
BitTorrent is the protocol people use to exchange information over the Internet in a peer-to-peer manner. So from me to you directly,
wow,
not going through another middleman. And it's famous because people use it to share media like movies and music.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's pirated. Some of it's not.
Okay, fair enough. DIY Bio. What is that?
So it's a name.
Mm-hmm.
It means you have an interest in doing amateur biology.
Mm-hmm. DIY stands for like do it yourself.
Do it right. Yourself biology. And the idea is it really the case that you need to spend 7 years of your life dedicated in a lab at academia or in an industrial lab to actually understand how to do genetic engineering or do molecular biology, which don't necessarily mean making new organisms.
So,
and it turns out you don't.
So evidently you haven't spent 7 years in a laboratory learning how to splice genes, right?
That's right.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
So if you, I guess you don't have time to spend 7 years anywhere back.
Right.
If you're 24.
Well, I spent 12 years in the primary education system, right?
There you are. So with respect to DIY Bio, what you folks are trying to do is bring genetic engineering to me. And,
that's right.
And engineer Nikki James and producer Carol Stafford. Is it possible for us to do that?
To do genetic engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can order a $40 kit from a couple of different educational or academic-grade supply companies, biological supply companies like Carolina Biosciences. For $40, they'll send you a genetic engineering kit. There's even one aimed at kids. It's called DNA Wizard, and you get to put fluorescent protein from jellyfish into bacteria.
Wow. Well, let's see. Also with us today, we have Susan Porter, who is a molecular biologist and chief of education at GeoSpiza up in Seattle, Washington. Susan, welcome to the Food Chain.
Actually, it's Sandra.
Sandra. I wrote Susan,
right.
And I should have wrote Sandra. Okay, Sandra, thank you for correcting me. And I'll note that right here. And Sandra, what is Geospiza?
Geospiza is the genus name of the finches that Darwin studied in the Galapagos.
Right.
And we picked the name because we're a bioinformatics software company.
Mm-hmm.
And all of bioinformatics is based on evolution.
So
we kind of wanted to convey that idea.
So you're a genetic software company?
Yes.
Is that what I heard? What exactly do you mean by genetic software? Because most of us are aware, of course, of...
Oh, no. Well, it's bioinformatics, and it's software that people use for genetic analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, let's say you had your doctor prescribed a genetic test. So maybe you signed up with 23andMe or Family Tree DNA, a company that offers genetic testing services.
Uh-huh.
They would use our software to keep track of your sample and keep it separated from others. They would also use it to analyze it and be able to tell you your results.
Huh. Okay, fair enough. Now, with respect to the whole notion, of course, I found you, Sandra, because you wrote an interesting article in the Genome Web about the world of DIY bio, and you were a little bit skeptical about the notion of do-it-yourself genetic engineering.
Right. I don't object to the whole idea, and I think it's pretty exciting. What concerns me is the idea about doing it in your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of art forms, for example, say I used to do stained glass, people can use lead and poison themselves. Okay. And some of the materials that you use when you're doing genetic engineering really require a little bit about understanding how to dispose of them properly. And so I think the whole field of DIY bio is looking into how to do this properly too.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just something that alerted me that putting antibiotic resistance genes into bacteria and pouring them down the sink, it's not, I mean, some people will be educated enough to know that that's not okay,
yeah.
But some people won't.
Well, and I guess that's some of the areas that we want to cover today as we get into this. But I'm going to go to Mac here. And Mac, are you careful about how you work with these materials? Are your people careful?
Yeah, I think that everyone's taking baby steps. Well, I mentioned that kit earlier. So a lot of the work has been on, it's really right now, it's not genetic engineering yet. It's engineering or it's biology 101. And the community is rebuilding and coming up with cheap or off-the-shelf versions of the basic, like, 101 curriculum, biology 101 mm-hmm. curriculum you'd learn in an advanced high school or undergraduate-level class.
Talk about the community. How big is the community?
The community is maybe, like, 750 or 800 people on a mailing list. And,
wow.
Like, 10% of those people actually talk, and then 10% of those people actually do things. So we're talking, like, a couple dozen people are actually out in the real world trying things. And some people don't do it in their kitchen. Some people do it in community workshops. And I think that that's something I'd like to talk about on the show, about the differences and how we can encourage different places to do this stuff.
Okay. Well, you know, Sandra, it sounds like that this DIY business is being taken up by some fairly conscientious people. Who are relatively concerned about what's going on. But wasn't that the case also with the computer industry when it started?
I wasn't part of the computer industry when it started.
Okay. Dude, weren't around, were you? Okay. But with respect, it was really a bunch of well-meaning people, and then, you know, a lot of people who weren't so well-meaning got into it too, didn't they?
Sure.
And then, is that part of your concern as well?
My concern more is of people doing things by accident.
By accident.
I'm not really worried about malicious malicious work. I really the thing is that when you do this kind of work in a school or university lab or community college lab, you have access to autoclaves and you have access.
What's an autoclave?
It's like a very fancy pressure cooker
mm-hmm.
that you can use to kill all your bacteria when you're done.
Ah.
Okay. And you have access to means of disposing of toxic chemicals. There's often an environmental safety officer. There are people that have the training that know how to dispose of things properly. And having, you know, that it's an infrastructure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in Seattle, I went to one of the Seattle DIY group meetings. And that's something we've been talking about, is could there be a lab that was set up with an infrastructure to handle those kinds of things, where people could work safely?
Kind of like farmers do when they hire a kitchen, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Cool, to make jelly or something like that, folks.
Right, like caterers, they're not allowed to just make food in their kitchen and sell it. They have standards.
Right. Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Mackenzie Cowell, who is the founder of DIY Bio, do-it-yourself genetic engineering. Also with us, we have Sandra Porter, who is a PhD molecular biologist for Geospeza in Seattle, Washington, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Should life be free for the making? What do you think? Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about creating life with genetic engineering. You take the genes from one living thing and you splice them together with or recombine them with the genes from another living thing and create a brand new living thing. And, you know, this used to be the purview of scientists in very fancy laboratories, but now it's becoming the purview of hobbyists in garages and kitchens and basements across the land, individuals taking it upon themselves to recreate new kinds of life. To demonstrate this kind of endeavor, I was going to invite Meredith Patterson, who is a computer scientist. She's currently residing in Belgium, and our Skype didn't quite work today, but perhaps Mackenzie Cowell, who is the founder of DIY Bio, could tell us a little bit about the project that Meredith was working on and give us all an idea of what the realm of possibilities is here. Mac, would you go ahead and kind
sure,
of
Sure, Michael. Thanks. Yeah, I'm bummed that she's not part of it. First, I have to say for the record that I'm one of the co-founders of DIY Bio. One of my other friends actually came up with the name at the same time as I did. So just so you know, just so the world
knows. You share naming rights. Well, with who?
With Jason Bobe from
Jason. Okay, good.
Boston. And Meredith is actually on chat with me right now, so we can maybe relay things like that.
Oh, good.
So her project was to take lactobacillus, which is the bacteria that make yogurt.
Yogurt, yeah.
And add a gene into them that make them turn red. That's sort of the first thing you can do as a genetic engineer to see if what you're doing works.
It's kind of like those test kits or those kits that you were talking about that they make for school children.
Yeah, exactly, right? Because you can see it. You don't need any special equipment to see the color change.
Okay, usually. So why do you want to turn yogurt red?
Well, like I said, it's the first thing to do to test if your genetic transformation recipe works.
Okay.
And it's sort of like the hello world for biology, or for biologists. So then, once that got going, when she got that to work, a lot of different organisms have a lot of different really neat biosensors, so they can sense different chemicals in the environment or other things.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that one
organism... For example,
melamine, right? The thing in the milk scare.
The famous Chinese non-protein protein, right?
Oh, yeah. So they were adding melamine to milk because it made it look like the milk had a lot more protein in it than
right.
it did.
Mm-hmm.
And it can cause
liver damage,
in
kidney
children
damage,
especially.
Right.
So she thought, wow, it would be great if we just had yogurt that could, in the presence of melamine over a couple hours, turn red. The idea would be you've got a kind of suspicious container, you add the yogurt to it, the special yogurt that she made, and if it turns red over a couple hours, you know that there's probably melamine in there. Don't drink it. And because it was biology, you could distribute it all over the world easily just by giving people a little bit of the yogurt. They can grow more, right? It's just like a yeast or a sourdough culture or something
right,
like that.
Right.
And so she's in the middle of working on that with another guy, Jonathan Klein.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a perfectly reasonable place to go. Let's talk with Sandra Porter and ask if she sees anything wrong with something like that. Sandra?
Right. I think it's pretty reasonable. The description sounds a little different than what Jonathan told me. I'd like the idea that it's something that you can see. He told me it was green fluorescent protein, which you'd have to have a black light to be able to detect.
Oh.
So now I'm hearing a little bit a different side of the story. I would, if it were me, I would put it on a dipstick or something so you could just stick it in a solution and see if it changes color, rather than having to carry yogurt around or lactobacillus around.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a fine idea.
So
the only thing is I'm wondering what the restrictions would be on transporting something like that over international borders and if that could be a problem.
Transporting genetically modified organisms from one place to the next?
Right.
Well, what would be the problem?
Well, a lot of countries regulate that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of countries regulate transport of food and import of food. Not very well in the case of melamine, certainly. But those are things that are subject to international law. And so I wonder what sort of obstacles that kind of thing would face.
Well, let's give Mac a try. Mac, are you there?
Yeah.
So what would be the problem with transporting from one country to the next?
I think Sandra's right. There are regulations that govern the transport across borders of GE foods and other organisms. I'm not up to speed on what those are.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if it was really a problem and the modified organism was easy enough to build and useful enough, people could just rebuild it wherever they were and get around that problem. But I think those laws are probably in place for, in some cases, good reasons, and in some cases, as reaction to hysteria over GE foods.
Well, Sandra, let me ask you, how do you go about reengineering a life form? I mean, could you describe that process for those of us who are kind of biologically illiterate, I guess?
Sure. There are many ways to do this, but I want to address one big misconception right now.
Sure.
And that is that this is an unnatural kind of thing, because believe it or not, there are bacteria out there that engineer life forms all the time. If you go out walking in the woods, you can find engineered trees and plants that were modified by bacteria.
For what? For the purposes of their own, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Hmm.
So what those bacteria do is they have special cartridges, you might say, that code for proteins that allow the bacteria to stick new DNA into a plant, and the plant starts making amino acids that feed the bacteria.
And that's how you create a new life form.
Yeah, so we use the methods. A lot of times you can use the methods that already exist like that.
Mm-hmm.
You could say, okay, I don't really care about making the amino acids that the bacteria want. I'd rather have a plant make something else. Like, say I want to make a rose, it's going to be blue or something.
Right.
I could put those genes in to the mechanism that the bacteria already uses, and the bacteria will put the genes in.
And let them do the work
for
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mac, is
that... Or I could use a virus. You know, there's a lot of ways.
Mac, evidently you don't need a multi-million dollar factory to do this.
That's right. I mean, biology, the substrate we're trying to engineer, the stuff we're trying to engineer, is all around us. And like Sandra just said, a lot of the biology has been modifying itself in some cases as well. And so in some ways, the machinery maybe to do the engineering is all around us. I think that in a lot of cases, science is a lot about it includes duct tape, right? And
right.
some gusto. And if you actually go into a lab, there's no actual secret million-dollar black box that does the work. It's just scientists being clever with the real world.
And probably clean.
I guess so. There's a company that's making 100% bacteria-produced gasoline. It's going to come online in 2012. So sunlight to gasoline, basically, with bacteria. And the interesting thing they run into is that you can keep everything sterile in small volumes, in liters.
Right.
But when you've got, like, refinery-sized volumes of bacteria making gasoline, one of their main design constraints is how do you make the system work reliably when it can't be sterile? And so in some way, I guess that means it's not clean. But I think that most people at the kind of level of work we're doing would agree that adding 70% ethanol to whatever it is you're working on sterilizes everything. And that's pretty easy to get a hold of.
It is not.
So Sandra disagrees.
Oh, good. We have Meredith Peterson joining us, too. So when we come back, we'll have a description of a great home-based experiment using a salad spinner to make a new life form from Meredith Peterson. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Matt Cowell, founder of DIY Bio. Sandra Porter, molecular biologist with Geospiza. And Meredith Peterson calling in from Belgium with a great experiment. Do stay tuned. Right back. What do you think out there? Should life be free for the making? Well, Meredith Peterson seems to think so because she was working in her kitchen in a San Francisco apartment to make a new life form for a yogurt. She wanted the yogurt to turn bright red should there be any melamine added to it, thus providing a great service for us all because we don't want to eat any yogurt with melamine in it. So that would have been a pretty interesting experiment or a pretty interesting result. Still working on that experiment, Meredith?
Yeah. My last name's Patterson, by the way. Sorry.
Patterson. Okay. Whoops. I'll chew out Carol Stafford for putting Peterson instead of Patterson.
Not a problem. Yeah. We're still, so Jonathan Klein and I are still working on ironing out some of the problems with using Lactobacillus acidophilus as our model organism. It's a somewhat more difficult organism to work with because of the structure of its cell wall.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working with E. coli, which is the bacteria that you'll get in the kits from Carolina Biological that Mackenzie was describing earlier, those are responsive to a transformation technique called heat shock, which literally is just as simple as dipping your vial of bacteria into a pot of hot water for about a minute and then pulling it out. If you have your bacteria and your plasmid DNA containing the new gene in the same solution, then you heat the bacteria up, the new gene goes in, and
wow.
If you're lucky, then some of the bacteria will start to produce it.
So that's real simple stuff.
Unfortunately, it is. It really is. And this has been going on in laboratories and high school classrooms for decades
mm-hmm.
at this point. So the cell walls of Lactobacillus bacteria are structured a bit differently, and heat shock does not work quite as well.
Okay.
I've been trying a couple of different techniques, and right now what we're working on is engineering our own electroporator, which is a device that exposes the bacteria to an electrical field and opens up pores in their cell walls for the plasmids to go in.
Visions of making Frankenstein with the electrical shock thing that they put on his head, you know, bzzz, one of those kinds of things?
No, it's really nowhere even near that exciting. I mean, we're talking about the kinds of electric currents they're used to power a neon sign.
Mm-hmm. Well, Meredith, one of the things that was really interested me about your story is that you're a computer scientist, and much of the DIY bio, or the whole notion that we can engineer our own life forms, I guess, comes from how relatively easy it has been to manipulate electrical impulses into information pathways. Is there a relationship between the technology of computers and the technology of genes?
I definitely think so. In fact, it's reasonable to think of DNA and RNA as a form of molecular computing. DNA is a very stable way of preserving information, which is later transcribed into RNA, and then RNA gets translated into proteins, which are, you know, proteins are what makes up you, me, cats, dogs, mice, everything living on Earth is made up of proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have this DNA storage technique, and information is encoded both directly in our genes and epigenetically when methylation occurs.
So,
I could get very... Go ahead.
So as a computer scientist, it's probably pretty easy for you to think in these terms, right? I mean, you kind of see the biology as a kind of a computer software program.
I do. And one thing that's a little unfortunate about that from time to time is that it's can be thinking of it a little too simplistically.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things that we still haven't discovered yet about how DNA and how genetics work. And we're learning them piece by piece. And, you know, working with synthetic biology is actually a way to help us learn what it is we haven't figured out yet about how DNA gets translated into living beings.
Okay, let's go talk with Sandra Porter, who is a molecular biologist. Sandra, do you see the science of genetic engineering to be similar to that of computer engineering?
I think as far as our understanding, how things work and how information is encoded, there are some similarities. There are conceptual similarities.
Mm-hmm.
As far as putting things into practice, there's a big difference in that with computers, it's pretty cheap. If you have a computer, you have what you need. With doing biological experiments, it's a lot more expensive and it takes a lot more time. In fact, they always kind of warn biologists not to start programming because it's such a quick reward as opposed to doing experiments.
Ah, okay, fair enough. I'm going to ask Mac. Now I'm going to try to pick up Mac. Okay, Mac, are you there?
Yep.
Let me ask you about the open software platform for genetic engineering. What DIY Bio and the whole world of do-it-yourself in biology seems to suggest here is that all of this should be open and available to anybody who wants to mess around with it. And I think of the computer model. I'm going to try this and see if we can get you. And we still got hold on for just a second here, and then we'll try it again. Okay, that should work. It seems like in the computer world, there was an IBM model and an Apple model, where IBM put their computer out and said, here, everybody can use it. And Apple said, I'm holding on to ours. And you folks with the DIY bio movement seem to be going to this open architecture, right?
Yeah, it's part of a larger trend. So there are hundreds of scientists around the world who have been working over the last maybe 10 years on something called synthetic biology. So they're doing all the hard scientific work.
Mm-hmm.
And some amateurs are starting to do some scientific work, too. That's
synthetic biology.
Yes, synthetic biology. Key word, okay? Because synthetic biology is aiming to make biology easier to engineer. Genetic engineering is a science. It's not an engineering discipline. Synthetic biology is trying to figure out how to make biology an engineering discipline so that when you're trying to engineer a particular feature or function or whatever you want, like Sander was saying, it takes too long and it's too expensive. So there's a sort of engineering cycle you get into. You have an idea, you model the idea, you instantiate the idea, you test it, it doesn't work, you change your idea, and you go around that cycle a bunch of times. That's the engineering cycle. How do we make it faster for biology? Synthetic biology is figuring it out. And part of the way they're going to do it is by figuring out how to share basic biological parts with other people without causing people to be concerned with intellectual property, like stacking. So if I build something useful using two of your basic like biological modules, like an on switch and a light sensor, how do I then feel confident that the thing I build with those two things won't come back down the line and be used against me to take away all my profit or to put me in jail, whatever. So I think that synthetic biologists and amateur biologists both are really interested in building an open architecture, including by beginning by building an open set of standard biological parts that...
Hold that thought. I'm going to take quick break. Right back, folks.
Okay.
This is The Food Chain. Do stay tuned. Well, what do you think out there? Should life be free for the making? Or should we patent it and own it, as has been done by the big folks like Monsanto and Syngenta and Genentech? They own a lot. How does the open architecture square with the world of patented ownership, Mackenzie?
Oh, wow. Well, so it's a really hard question to answer because the patent system and the copyright system and the other legal vehicles that can be used to control ownership of intellectual property, I guess that's what you end up doing with biology, is making it intellectual mm-hmm. property. Those things are all complicated. So it's so complicated that a team of crack like lawyers and scientists from the BioBricks Foundation, you can Google them, have been trying to figure this out, and they're about to announce what they are calling the biological public agreement. And it's how it will let people say, this part can be freely used with other parts, as long as any parts you use to make a new device are also contributed to the commons. So they're trying to encourage people to create a commons of freely used basic biological parts. I'm excited about it.
Okay. Sandra, are you excited about it too?
Sandra? Oh, you're asking me? Oh, I wasn't sure if you're asking me or Meredith.
I'm sorry.
This is the first I've heard of it. I think it's a really good idea, because I could see that the patent issue and the issue of things that are already patented being a big problem for DIY bio. I mean, and it is complicated. There was a story not too long ago about a scientist who developed rice that produced vitamin A, and unfortunately wasn't able to share it with the world very easily because he had unwittingly infringed on all kinds of patents.
Right.
And so if somebody who has a PhD and has been working on this all their lives can do this by mistake, it seems like these things are going to complicate life for the DIY people as well.
Meredith, are you? Let's see, Sandra, are you there?
Yeah.
Now, what about you? Are you as captivated by the whole notion of open architecture?
I think it's great.
So we're all there.
It's going to be tricky to figure out what things are open.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a company should be able to own life?
Well, it's not. Well, so right now they can't really own life. What they can do is they can patent the use of something for a particular purpose. Okay.
Okay.
So let's say I wanted to make a genetic test for, HIV. Okay. And I said I wanted to use this 15 base sequence and this other 15 base sequence to copy the HIV so that I could have my test. Okay.
Right.
I could patent those 15 base sequences for my test.
For that test only. So you couldn't really own it for the rest, for everything then.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Or I could say I wanted to patent this 100 base sequence to use to control the production of a protein for this particular purpose.
Okay.
Samuel, so you're not necessarily patenting life, you're patenting a part.
And? Did we lose you?
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, so it's patenting something for a purpose. So there are ways to get around those kinds of things. It's just you have to know, you do have to do some research to figure out what you can and can't do.
Okay, let me ask you some real basic questions then. Is there, let's start with you, Sandra, is there any limit to what kind of life we might create in laboratories, big and small, and professional and hobby?
Oh, well, it's hard to say what the limits are as far as what might be created, but I think the biggest challenge is that to create something new would be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
To modify something that exists and just change it a little bit so an enzyme might be more efficient or might get turned on in response to a chemical, that's pretty doable.
That's pretty doable. Let me ask you this. A caller calls in and says, what happens when your neighbor invents a flesh-eating bacteria?
Your neighbor doesn't have to invent them. They're out there.
They're out there. What if he takes a regular bacteria and by accident, you know, you have this Frankenstein flesh-eating bacteria out? Is that in the realm of possibilities here?
I think it's unlikely, but I do think this is something that the DIY community will have to work on. There is a set of regulations that were set up by the National Institutes of Health and the Recombinant DNA uh-huh. Advisory Committee. And to work with toxins or things of that nature was something that is something that's restricted, or at least if you're getting an NIH grant, it's
okay.
restricted.
Well, and I don't
think
McKinsey's going to be looking for an NIH grant, though.
Right. But I think the community can choose to adopt standards and safety protocols.
Mm-hmm.
And can say these things are okay and these things are not.
Okay, thank you very much. Meredith, what about you? Do you see this? Do you see the community adopting these?
Absolutely. We've got a number of people, Brian Bishop, Tito Jankowski, myself, Mackenzie, Jason Morrison, Jason Bobe, actively working on safety guidelines for everybody. We're mm-hmm. encouraging people to keep copies of material safety data sheets and follow them to the letter. And the community has already chided people for suggesting things that we think would be dangerous. Like, you know, every once in a while somebody comes along and suggests, culturing E. coli from feces, and we all jump up screaming, no, that's a terrible idea, don't do it.
Well, okay, and when we're going to take one final break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask all of you, what happens when we get to the inevitable hacker who isn't going to play by the rules and is out to do harm? We will be right back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Do stay tuned. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, what about it out there? Will all gene hackers be responsible, or will some one run wild and free like their cousins, the computer hackers and spammers? What do you think? We're here to ask people who might know. Mackenzie Cowell, founder of DIY Bio, co-founder of DIY Bio. Also, Meredith Patterson, who is a computer scientist working on her PhD in Belgium. And also, Sandra Porter, who is a PhD molecular biologist and chief of education for GeoSpiza up there in Seattle, Washington. Mackenzie, let's start with you. How is it possible to regulate this world of do-it-yourself genetic engineering?
Well, okay, so if the cat's out of the bag, it's
right.
hard to herd cats, you can still do it. So I think regulation is possible. It's necessary for us to have a good relationship with existing scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists basically may be thinking right now, oh, who are you in your garage doing this genetic engineering stuff? What's your safety framework? And the person's like, oh, yeah, I'm safe. And they're like, well, the scientist says something like, well, I'm not so, I don't know. Are you really? So we need something that we can point to that represents the creed of DIY Bio towards safety.
Mm-hmm.
But on the larger issue of, you know, regardless of whether or not someone identifies themselves with our community, the ability is out there for someone to go to grad school and get the technical skills they need to build something really hard but bad. Or maybe in 5 or 10 years it'll be trivial to build something hard but bad. I'm not sure about that. So I think that...
Trivial?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's 5 years away.
Yeah.
So what I think is that bio-error or bio-terror is inevitable at some time scale, 10, 20 years, 100 years. Nature's been trying to kill us for a really long time, right? I'm more concerned about avian flu. And I would prefer to live in a world with more experts, so I don't just have to rely on academics and the government to come up with a solution, but I can go down to my local high school or just down the block to the local amateur hobbyist who knows a lot about this stuff and say, what's going on? Should I be concerned about this? What are we going to do? And maybe one of those people will invent a solution to the problem. And lastly, I just want to point out that one of the cool DIY bio projects is called BioWeatherMaps, and it's about biosurveillance. And so I think that
So, for example, if there was an E. coli outbreak somewhere, you would be able to detect it with a...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
as we encourage and increase the ability to do engineering, distributed, as if we're encouraging distributed genetic engineering, we should also empower distributed surveillance.
Good. Okay, Sandra, I guess you can't put the genie back in the bottle, can you?
No, and Mackenzie brings up some good points. Remember the anthrax issues?
Right.
There's the FBI thought that was a scientist working for the Army.
Yep.
A microbiologist. So, I mean, the genie, there are a lot of risks already that exist.
Meredith?
And, yeah.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
One thing I just wanted to point out is that one thing that we've seen in the industry already, in the supply chain, is companies that provide primers and synthesize DNA, like my former employer, Integrated DNA Technologies out of Iowa, they participate in an industry watch list that they call Black Watch.
So they've got somebody's watching.
Yeah, basically every time somebody puts in a request for a primer, they will validate it against a list of potentially dangerous sequences.
Okay, out of time, Mackenzie Cowell, Meredith Patterson, Sandra Porter, thank you all for joining in. Remember, folks, stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.